Hello everybody and welcome to F1 Top 5, the show where we count down your top 5 Formula 1 related lists. We'll start with Alex Andronov, who has a closer look at sponsorship in F1.
Hello Side Podcast, this is Alex Andronov from Sofa F1, calling with my top 5 companies who should sponsor F1 but don't. In 5th place, the BBC. They could have Eddie Jordan running the team and claiming that he invented Formula 1 while Jake drives around getting giddy with excitement. 4th place, Fruit Loops. Fruity Loops of goodness. The F1 drivers get 60 to 70 of their 5 a day from going round in loops. 3rd, Fujifilm. With Fuji Racetrack off the calendar, they'll have to raise the profile of their mountain somehow. 2nd, Microsoft. Although they would have to be very careful to make sure that their cars don't crash. 1st, British Airways and Air France jointly. Well, they did have their own Concorde agreement at one time.
Next up is the first of a few lists from Gavin Brown, this one to do with a country close to his heart.
Gavin's top 5 Kiwi drivers. Now, this is quite an easy list because as far as I can tell, there's only been 5 Kiwi drivers. So number 1 would have to be Denny Holm. He won the World Championship. Need I say more? Number 2, Bruce McLaren. He set up the legendary McLaren team and had a lot of success in various types of motorsport. Sadly, he died before he could have a fully successful career. Number 3, Chris Amon. The unluckiest guy never to win a race. Top bloke, I've met him, he's fantastic. And Ferrari called him his best ever test driver. Number 4 would be Mike Thackwell. Relatively unknown, however, he had quite a good career in Formula 2 and apparently was better than his machinery allowed him to be in Formula 1. Finally, number 5 would be Howden Ganley. Howden who? Well, he had a bit of a career in the early 70s but didn't really make it that far. So that's my top 5 Kiwi drivers.
From drivers to team principals, and John Waldock has delved into some statistics for us.
Hello, Side Podcast. This is John Waldock here with your top 5 F1 team principals. In 5th, we have Flavio Briatore with 3 Constructor Championships and 4 Drivers' Championships. In 4th, we have Jean Todt with 7 Constructor Championships and 6 Drivers' Championships. In 3rd is Ross Brawn with 7 Constructors and 7 Drivers. In 2nd is Patrick Head with 9 Constructors and 7 Drivers. And in the lead is Ron Dennis with 7 Constructors and 10 Drivers' Championships.
Jernia is our next guest to count down the top 5 heartbreaking F1 moments, although he sneakily makes it a top 10.
Top 5 heartbreakers. So I'll make it a little different. I'll change the name a bit. I'll call it the top 5 heartbreaking moments in F1. There's actually 10 here on my list, but it's obviously a top 5 show, so I can't do more than 5. But I will mention the honorable mentions, the ones in any order from 6th to 10th. We have Jack Brabham in the 1970 Monaco Grand Prix. He crashed in the final corner of the last lap at what would now be the Rascasse hairpin. Another one is Ayrton Senna crashing out of the 1988 Monaco Grand Prix at Poitiers after dominating the whole Grand Prix. And of course, there is that story where he ran off to his hotel, to his apartment, basically, to shed tears. Another one is Damon Hill from the 1997 Hungarian Grand Prix. He was in a very good position to take the first Grand Prix win for Arrows, but mechanical trouble ensured that he wouldn't, and the win would be cruelly robbed away from him. He would have to settle for second behind Jacques Villeneuve. Another one is Kimi Raikkonen in the 2005 European Grand Prix. I know this is one of Amy's most heartbreaking moments. This is the one where Kimi was struggling with tire blisters, and his suspension gave way on the last lap, costing him a race win. And the 5th one would be Sebastian Vettel in the 2007 Japanese Grand Prix, if you remember him running into Mark Webber. They were running 2nd and 3rd. They took each other out of any contention for the race win, and there was a subsequent YouTube investigation for that. But that's another story. So, moving on now to my top 5 list, here are the top 5 heartbreaking moments in F1. Number 5 is from the 1986 Australian Grand Prix, and that would have to be Nigel Mansell. Now, Nigel Mansell was in contention for the championship. He only needed to finish 3rd to win, and he was well on his way to achieving that before his tire blew itself, into bits, and there was much shock and awe, especially those watching in the, on TV, because a lot of people were expecting Mansell to cruise to the World Championship, and it would take him another 6 years before he would finally win that World Championship. Number four is from the 1999 Italian Grand Prix, and this is the one where Mika Häkkinen spun out at the first chicane while leading. Now, this is a very emotional moment, because if you watch this race, you would know that after Mika went out, he jumped out of the car, he slammed his gloves onto the dirt, and then he jumped over the barrier. And on the other side, it was later shown from a helicopter shot that he was crying, and there was a lot of discussion about that. He was crying amidst the roars and cheers of the Tifosi, who wanted Eddie Irvine to win Ferrari's first championship in 20 years. Number three comes from the race after that, the 1999 European Grand Prix, and this could only be Luca Badoer. Luca Badoer, who was running in fourth position in the Minardi, never before had he run so high up the order, and not only that, he was catching the battle for second between Jano Trulli and Rubens Barrichello before his gearbox packed up, and there was nothing he could do. And just like Häkkinen, he leapt out of the cockpit of his car, and he shed tears. It was a very, very emotional moment. It was Badoer's best chance to score points, and he never managed to score those elusive Grand Prix points. Number two is from a much more recent season, last season, 2008, Adrian Sutil in Monaco. And if you remember, he was running in between the two Ferraris, Massa ahead, Raikkonen behind, and he was looking very good indeed to score a lot of points for Force India. But Kimi Raikkonen lost control of his car and ended up smashing straight into the rear of Sutil's Force India. And the team were absolutely distraught. Adrian Sutil, if you remember, was in tears. And Kimi Raikkonen had to apologize for taking Sutil out. And if you will notice, Kimi Raikkonen has shattered the hopes and dreams of many a Force India race. He also took out Sutil at the European Grand Prix this year. And he was the one that stopped Giancarlo Fisichella from winning the Belgian Grand Prix just a couple of weeks ago. But the number one, top one, heartbreaking moment in F1 has to be the 2008 Brazilian Grand Prix in Felipe Massa. If you will notice, of the top five, Massa is the only one who actually managed to finish the race he was in. In fact, he won that race. But, as you all know, he was champion for around 30, 45 seconds. But again, as history would prove, Lewis Hamilton taking the crucial fifth place from Timo Glock in the closing stages, and Massa would not win the world championship. And he was in tears, if you would remember, in the slowdown lap and as he was leaving his car in Parc Fermé. But many would praise the way he handled it. He was a gentleman all the way and said nothing wrong and even congratulated Lewis Hamilton. So there you have it, the top five heartbreaking moments in F1.
To brighten the mood a little, let's hear from Lukey, who has a closer look at some ITV commentating specials.
Hello, it's Lukey here. I'm going to be doing the top five blunderisms, because Mark Blundell was absolutely awesome in a really, truly horrible way. He was just fun, wasn't he? But these are my top five blunderisms. Number five. This is a bit of philosophy from Mark Blundell. China, I think a lot of us are left thinking, what really happened there? Truly wonderful stuff. Number four, Rubens, I don't know what's happening to Rubens here, but big thing for me then, Rubens Barrichello, big impression. Now he's made his mark, definitely within starting that third place at this moment in time. At this moment in time, really big thing. Okay. Number three, this is Mark talking about Brazil 2008. A last lap, what made the GP very special. He is so down with the kids, it's not even funny. What made the GP wonderful? Number two, this is Mark's take on strategy. And I don't think I'm going to do this in one go, but I'll try. I don't think there's anything strategy there, what went wrong at all. Sorry, I don't even know where to start on that one. And now, number one. This is Mark Blundell's take. Oof, see for yourself. As the championship develops, I think we really do have a championship on our hands. Just so true and brilliant. Anyway, that is my top five Blundellisms about a wonderful man called Mark Blundell, who obviously has no grasp on the English language.
Over to Stephen Roy, who is wrestling up something good in the dining room.
Top five F1 people to have to dinner. I think this week, those five pick themselves. Max Mosley, Flavio Briatore, Pat Simmons, Fernando Alonso, and Nelson Piquet Sr. No point putting Junior there because he'll just sit in the corner and do as he's told, as we've learned. Put Piquet Sr. in there and that'll really stir it up. And you just sit back with a nice glass of wine and watch them all go at it, try to blame each other.
Whilst we're talking about food, sort of, here's Nick.
Hello, Sidepod Radio. Nick here. I have my top five here for the top five show. It's my top five F1 food hybrids. I'm not even sure what it is, but it's the top five, so hopefully that's good. The idea came from the comments when Amy was saying that her phone automatically made Burger King turn into Burger Kimmy. So I thought I'd run with that for a bit. I've got a top five in no particular order, except it starts badly, so it has to get better. First one is Pizzonia Hut. Then we go to Takuma Sate, followed up quickly by Kazuki Big Macajima. Then moving on to the new boy, Jaime Algu Stir Fry. And the final one is, this was suggested by Amy, Heike Koval Onion. Alright, hope the day's going well. Thanks a lot.
Let's hear from Gavin again, at this time trying to cheer his favourite driver up.
Top five Lewis Hamilton things, because I think Lewis Hamilton needs some love at the moment, and you know, he still hasn't called me. So, number one, his win in Britain last year, because he absolutely destroyed the whole field and his drive was fantastic. Number two, his world championship win, because he kept us excited for a whole season and managed to win it on the final corner of the final race of the year. Number three, well, this season has been pretty good too. He's taken basically what was a really shoddy Mercedes truck and turned it into a winning Formula One car. Now that's just awesome. Number four, his TV segments are pretty good. I mean, when he's allowed to be let off the leash a bit, for example, in the adverts he does where he's acting, or when he races against Jake, that's pretty cool. And number five, I guess the fact that he's basically a little kid, that he's got his dream came true, and that's just fantastic. He always acts like it really is a dream, and he's always so proud to be there, even when things are going tough.
It's fair to say Lewis has been a controversial driver occasionally, so that leads us nicely on to John's second list.
And now we have the top five most controversial F1 penalties of the new F1 era. In the fifth position we have Massa Bordet, Japan 08, where Bordet was blamed for the crash that happened at the first corner at turn one. In fourth we have Lewis Hamilton, Spa 08, where he was penalised for letting Raikkonen back through and then overtaking on his slipstream. In third we have McLaren, Spygate, where they were given that huge fine and banned from the Constructors' Championship of that year. And in second we have Renault Piquet-Gate 09, where this penalty hasn't actually happened yet, but we expect this one to be one of the most controversial penalties of the Formula One new era. And in first place we have Monza 2006, where Fernando Alonso was penalised for impeding Felipe Massa even though he was 100 metres in front of him, but the FIA claimed that Massa lost some downforce from it.
Back to the drivers again, and Paul counts down the top five Australian drivers.
Hello, Sidepod Radio. It's Paul from Australia here, and I'm calling in my top five, and you guessed it, Australian drivers, which sounded like a good idea at the time until I started looking for five Australian Formula One drivers. But we'll start out and see where it ends up. I'm going to go from one to five rather than the normal five to one for reasons that will become obvious a bit later, I think. So number one, I think, is pretty obvious. That's Jack Brabham. 3-time world champion, 14 wins, and I believe the only driver to win a world championship as constructor as well, when he won in his own car in 1966. Number two is Australia's only other world champion. That's Alan Jones, when he won in 1980, winning Williams's first world championship. I think 12 race wins for Alan, and probably would have gone close in 1981 as well if it wasn't for his teammate. Number three on the list, Mark Webber, who is Australia's only other Grand Prix winner, thanks to this year. Looks like the curse is lifted, finally. Then we get to four and five, and this is where I had all sorts of trouble. Looks like Australia's had 15 or so drivers that have competed in Grand Prix over the years, but none of the others have really distinguished themselves in Formula One. So I had to look through and decide who I'd choose for the other two places. We've had a few drivers that have distinguished themselves in other classes after driving in Formula One. Pick number four would be David Brabham, that's right. both Gary and David competed in Formula One, and both of them went on to win Le Mans afterwards. But I think I picked David because he seems to have had a better sports car career after pretty much having a dud Formula One career. And finally, number five, I picked Vern Schuppan. Now, Vern had not much of a Formula One career. According to Wikipedia, he was disqualified from two of his, 11 races. Retired from three and finished four. But he did go on to a pretty distinguished career in sports cars and won Le Mans in 1983 with Porsche. So there you go. That's my top five.
This time, Gavin has narrowed it down by driver and by team.
Top five Williams drivers. How about that one? Number one, Nigel Mansell. He's my personal favourite. I know he's a whinger, but he was a great driver and he seemed to always punch above his weight, and he got me into Formula One, so I like him. Number two, probably Montoya, because he's the Colombian Mansell, basically, and I miss him in Formula One. We need characters like him come back. Number three, probably Damon Hill. Saw him at a Grand Prix. Yeah, no, he wasn't the best of drivers, but, you know, he did race against you-know-who, and on his day could beat him, so that's good enough for me. Number four, Riccardo Patrese, because he was underrated, and in 91 actually was beating Mansell at some point, and then the electronic stuff, he didn't really like it, so he kind of wasn't good after that. Number five, probably go for Alan Jones, because Alan Jones is Alan Jones, and he's outspoken, and he won Williams' first world championship. So yeah, I think that's my top five there.
Let's splash a bit of colour into our lists with RG's top five worst liveries.
Hello, RG here. Hope you can hear us fine. Just calling in for the top five worst five liveries, if that makes any sense at all. First, a few rules I've just set in place to go back to 1992. Mainly that's because if I use full liveries, brilliant F1 Wolf. He had all the liveries up back until 92. And basically, I wasn't bothered enough to go back any further. So I'll start now. Number five, worst livery since the 90s, is the Larousse 1993. The only problem I'm finding with this car is it's just basically a lot of colours mixed together, and it doesn't just look like a mess. Number four, I've got the BAR from 1999. Obvious choice, I suppose, but I mean, the idea of putting two liveries in one car really doesn't make any sense. If it makes it worse, I'm pretty sure it would have been much more sense if they'd, say, managed to choose one livery over the other. And basically, that would have been much nicer indeed. At number three is the Jordan 1996 car. Basically, what they did was put gold on it, and basically they made it look absolutely horrible, and it didn't look nice at all. Basically that then. I feel like I'm fine for these. Number two, well, not surprised, maybe I didn't expect in this one, but the Minardi from 2000. I don't know if you remember the car. Very sickly coloured looking cards. Not exactly yellow, but I can't describe the colour. You type it in Google, Minardi 2000, I'm pretty sure you'll find it. And, number one, worst livery since 1992. Well, worst livery ever, I might guess, anyway. Reynolds livery from 2007 to 2009. It would be easier describing what isn't wrong with that car. And probably the only thing about that is that Fernando Alonso was driving it. I'd like to give out a few honourable mentions. Cars that just got me pipped to the post. Williams from 1998 to 1999. It was nice. The Williams from 2001 to 2005. Again, very boring. I missed out 2000 on purpose because I actually liked that car. I don't know why. It's not surprise a few of you, but BMW Sauber 2006 to 2009. It was immensely boring. Force India 2008. Again, it's the goal issue. And this may lose a few friends. Born GP. Bye!
Stephen again, and this time he's a man after my own heart.
Five reasons why the off-season is great. I love the off-season. You get speculation. What a reason that is. You speculate who's going to go where, who's going to have a good car, who's going to have a bad car, which technical people have gone where, who's going to adapt to the new regulations. The off-season is great for that because you get months and months and months of speculation before anyone can be proved right or wrong, so everyone's views are equally valid. We've got testing. Now, we all love to look at a test where it's one guy on his own on the track and try and analyse what we can from that, whether his car's going to be competitive, it's not competitive, whether it's too ugly to be allowed on the track again. We all love to sit and try and analyse testing, even though at the end of it we tend to agree that you can't, but it's always a good way of filling the winter. Third thing I pick is driver off-track activities, like the Race of Champions, which is on-track, not off-track, but it's not an F1 track, so it's really off-track. But drivers in situations like that, where you end up with things like Heikki when he's in GP2 beating Schumacher in the Race of Champions, things like that are fabulous. Then you've got all the fourth thing I'd have is all the other formula, things like A1 GP, GP2 Asia, where you can see drivers you don't normally see, or cars you don't normally see, or circuits you don't normally see, and you get to try and assess what's coming up and just take a different look at a sport instead of watching something where you know every little detail about it better than the commentators. You can sit and watch something and enjoy it and try and understand it. That's always good. Fifth, final thing why the off-season is great is Autosport International. Now, I know some people who are only interested in Formula 1 don't think it is, but if you go there, look at the other stuff, look at the different cars, all the old cars that are there, you get to listen to people speak who you don't normally get listen to speak. If you're into autographs, you can go and get autographs, you can actually talk to people in a situation where they're more relaxed, and they have Frank. What more could you possibly want? I love the off-season. The only thing better than the off-season is the season. So okay, it's second best, but what a second best. Everyone should love the off-season.
Now for a little bit of self-indulgence, again from Gavin.
Top five side podcast shows, in no particular order. So there won't be like best to worst or anything like that, just top five. The first one has to be the debrief, because basically it's the only way to discuss the race after the race, and it's so much fun to watch live, and it's even better as a podcast. I've got quite caught out a few times at work when I've been chuckling for no reason, so thank you, Side Podcast. Number two has to be Side Pod Panel, because I've had so much fun being part of that. It's just absolutely brilliant. My sides hurt with laughter afterwards, and it's loads of fun, and you get to do impressions of Formula 1 drivers and just generally take the mic, and it's just brilliant. Number three has to be A Side with Joe. I just think it's brilliant that you guys have managed to get in touch with regularly a Formula 1 journalist who's inside the paddock and gives you the proper and authoritative story on what's going on, and just brilliant to listen to. Number four, F1 Minute. because, you know, it's just F1 in a minute every day, and it's really condensed and it's really cool. And number five, the F1 Digest, because that's just a cool way to wrap up what happens in each of the sessions. So that's my top five side podcast shows.
Almost there, we've got Amy with a list that must have been hard for her to narrow down.
Hi, this is Amy, and these are the top five Finns in Formula One. In fifth place is Mika Salo, whose claims to fame include replacing Michael Schumacher at Ferrari after he broke his leg in 99 and scoring their first ever point for Toyota at their debut in 2002. In fourth place, Keke Rosberg, who won the 1982 championship, but loses points for introducing the world to Nico and letting him be German when everybody knows that Finns are better. In third place is Heikki Kovalainen, who is fantastic, and I will not be told otherwise. He has one lucky win to his name, but I am wisely predicting that he will win every remaining race this season. Second is Kimi Raikkonen, who was amazing at McLaren, but then went and won his championship for the wrong team. If his rumoured return to McLaren happens, I might just have to bump him up to number one. For now, the actual number one is Mika Häkkinen, the Finn with the most championships, with two for McLaren. Plus, Mika Häkkinen is pretty fun to say.
And we finish with Stuart Codling's glimpse into paddock life.
Hello, this is me. Well, actually, no, it's not me, because that's you. Well, one of you. Anyway, this is Stuart, and I'm phoning with my top five Formula One-related things. I suppose the list I would choose is the top five grid goons. These are the people who perpetually try to gatecrash the Brundle grid walk, and they're usually members of the British press. It's sort of difficult to rank them at 1 to 5, but I'll have a go. I would say that the number one grid goon, the person who shamelessly follows Martin around, is Ian Parkes of the PA. You can tell him he's a sort of a moderately heighted fellow with short, sandy-coloured hair. And he is often to be seen somewhere over Martin's shoulder, consulting his phone, or at least pretending to, probably from bringing his mate, saying, come here on the telly. Second, I would say, is Ian Gordon of the News of the World / The Sun. You can tell him because, he's a sort of a rounded figure, likes his red wine, as you can tell by stature, perhaps. And he often is seen hanging around in the vicinity of Byron Young of the Daily Mirror, because, of course, tabloid journalists, like birds of a feather, flock together. How many have we had? We've had three now. Who's the fourth goon? That's a tricky one. I would say Adam Cooper, the Autosport correspondent. You can tell him because he's probably, I'd say, the only person on the Formula, well, who hangs around in Formula One, who hasn't realised that a ponytail is the mark of Satan. Five, I would say Jonathan Noble, who I've noticed has got an identical pair of glasses to me recently. You know him because he's got reactor-like lenses that in dark weather conditions make him look like a German paedophile. Anyway, that's it. That's five from me. Goodbye.
What a way to end. Thanks to everyone who submitted their lists. I hope you enjoyed the show.